This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In her new book, Private Matters, Jana Malamud-Smith explores the contradictory ideas we have about privacy in our homes, in our sex lives, and in the lives of our celebrities. She's had to confront thorny questions about privacy as the daughter of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Bernard Malamud. He was best known for his books The Natural, The Fixer, and The Assistant. After his death in 1986, Jana and her mother had to puzzle through where to draw the line between public and private as they settled his literary estate and dealt with questions about his personal life from reporters and biographers. Jana Malamud-Smith told me her father had left a lot of mixed messages about what he would have wanted.
Well, on the one hand, he was an extremely private man who had trouble talking about himself and who was often very, very reticent and who put a lot of energy into protecting the fiction that he was writing by not saying much about his life. And on the other hand, he was a man who loved biographies and would call me on the phone when he was in the middle of one that really excited him and tell me a detail from a writer's life that grabbed him.
Well, how did not revealing a lot about himself personally protect his fiction?
I think that one of the things that seems to me to be happening more and more with fiction is that we see fiction as sort of a world map that we can stick pins into by trying to locate the facts of a writer's life vis-a-vis the experiences that he describes in his characters. And I think that Dad felt that in order for fiction to thrive, you really wanted that process not to be terribly successful.
What was your mother's position, finally, when she was approached by biographers and scholars for personal information about your father, or for letters that he had written to her over the years?
Right. It's an ongoing work in progress, and I think that one of the things that I discovered in writing the book is that my position about this has shifted somewhat in time, and I think to some degree hers has too, in the sense that when someone's been dead a decade or now 11 years, as my father has, some of the urgency that you might feel early on to be protective begins to mellow a little bit. On the other hand, we are now just in the process of figuring out what to do with his notebooks and his most personal letters. And recently I went to the safe deposit box and actually looked at a pile of the letters that my mother and father had exchanged early in their relationship, during their courtship, in fact. And I had this visceral reaction that kind of surprised me, saying, ooh, I'm not sure I want this to be sitting in some library anywhere. This is my mom. This is my dad. This is my family past. And I didn't say anything about it to my mother, but who called me a number of nights later herself and said, you know, Jana, I'm not so sure that I feel comfortable having these letters out there. It feels a little creepy. It feels like giving over the flesh of another person in some way.
What about the argument that, you know, after a writer dies, the full truth, the full dimensionality of this writer should be made public?
Well, if only we could ever make the full truth of somebody public, first of all. I think that in principle, probably the full dimensionality should be made public, but I'm not sure it's quite so simple as that. I think that the things that I would weigh are allowing some time to pass. And in the book, I talk about Leon Adele's biography of Henry James. James had been dead for 50 years when Adele writes about him, and somehow that seems very healthy to me. But even if one does a more contemporary biography, the question is how you tell the story in the biography and what you honor and what you respect. And, you know, it isn't just simply a question of telling or not telling. I think there's much more to be said about how we tell, because in how we tell, we either give honor to people or we devalue them in ways that probably aren't terribly good for the whole culture in some sense.
You first had to deal with the issue of privacy after your father became a famous writer. What were the first family concerns about privacy when suddenly there were requests for interviews and magazine stories?
Right. The first that I sort of knew of that, I mean, I certainly was aware from childhood that my father's career was moving along pretty well. And I can remember when I was young and we lived in Oregon and he got his first National Book Award and he went east. And I can remember, I must have been eight. I'm not even sure I was that old, but I can remember him reporting that he had seen Marilyn Monroe there because she was with Arthur Miller. So throughout my life, as I was growing up, it was beginning to seep in. But not until The Fixer was published in 1966 did he become really quite well known. And I remember the first time that came knocked on the door was when the Saturday Evening Post, I think it was, wanted to come and stay in our house for 3 days and photograph him in the midst of his family. And I think on the one hand, he was very excited by that because he was the son of an immigrant grocer and he'd had a tough growing up. And this was really, to him, to some degree, a sign that he had arrived in a world I think he was wanting to arrive in. And on the other hand, he really thought carefully about whether this was good for his family life and for his kids. And I think he decided it wasn't.
You said that your solution to your father's fame was to seek anonymity yourself. Why did you want it and how did you seek it?
I wanted anonymity because it happened that about the same time that he became famous was the same time that I became a teenager and started moving in a world where I was touchy about the number of people who would say, oh, yeah, you got that because you were Malamud's daughter. Or, oh, who are you? You're Malamud's daughter. And it turns out as one is seeking to assert one's own identity, this becomes a somewhat clouding way of thinking about oneself. So I fled from that world and went to social work school and spent about 14 years working in a wonderful clinic in a housing project.
And what are you doing now?
I am still working as a social worker, both in private practice and at the Cambridge Hospital, which is a hospital in Cambridge that works a lot in the public domain.
And do you still feel like anonymity is what you want, or do you want a lot of recognition only just enough for being your father's daughter?
Well, I've certainly outed myself as a woman who wants anonymity. Here I am talking to you, so that would be a risky proposition to claim that right now. I think that I've tried very hard to understand how I feel about privacy, and I knew that when I started writing that I would be deciding that anonymity wasn't so important to me anymore. And I think when you're 45, as I am, and married and with kids, you have a different idea about yourself. So I don't think that I feel so much that I need that space.
You point out that we seem to be heading in two directions at one time in terms of privacy. On the one hand, we have more privacy as individuals, more privacy at home. On the other hand, through the new high technology and the internet, people have access to private data about us, people who never had this kind of access before. Would you elaborate on these two directions at once?
Exactly. No, you put your finger on something really, I think, that's really important. On the one hand, when, you know, like driving around today to come from my work to here or in my whole day-to-day, I run into people, but there's no one who I run into who observes my life coherently from the beginning of the morning till the end of the night. And even though right now that's an extraordinarily common experience, I think it's historically somewhat atypical that I think people who've mostly lived in other times in villages and in smaller towns are used to being much more coherently observed. And that kind of the way that we watch each other, the eyes that are on us, the way that we think about the eyes that are on us, have a lot to do with how we behave and a lot to do with how we think about ourselves. And I think in return, as we begin to discover how much anonymity we've created in the world, we're really panicking because it turns out that an enormous amount of anonymity doesn't become privacy. It becomes isolation and it becomes harmful in certain ways because people don't feel known. And when people don't feel known, they, among other things, get lonely and, among other things, are more inclined to do things that probably aren't terribly toward the common good, you might say. You know, the watching us tends to keep us on our toes a little bit. So I think that what we've substituted is this electronic surveillance where the bank keeps track of us and the tax people keep track of us and the insurance companies keep track of us and God knows only who else keeps track of us. But all of we're watched from a distance in a amazing way. And I think that we haven't paid adequate attention to the way that this kind of more distant bureaucratic surveillance has replaced the more historical surveillance of knowing each other.
Well, it's not like we want it that way.
Yeah. Well, we do and we don't, because think about it. If I go to the bank and it's dark at night and I go into that little place where I can get money out of the machine and there's a camera there, I sort of do want that one.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah, I kind of want that too. Right.
Yeah, so
if somebody mugs you, you've got their photograph.
Exactly, you know?
Yeah.
So I think we each want a piece of it when we feel mm-hmm. ourselves to have more to gain than lose by it.
You know, in some ways, I think our culture today doesn't value certain forms of privacy the way it used to. I'm thinking here of the way people willingly and openly reveal things about their lives that used to be considered much too personal and private to talk about in public. And certainly on the TV talk shows, here on Fresh Air, I ask people very personal questions mm-hmm. if they are open to that kind of questioning and if I think it's going to be revealing of their larger work. How does that strike you, this sense of things that used to be just private, period, are now part of the public discussion?
Yeah, I think it's something that is both good and bad. And I think that probably when you ask a probing question, it's one of the reasons that so many of us enjoy listening to you, because oftentimes there's time for people to give a person to give a considered answer, and you listen back. And, you know, it's a nice dialectic or dialogue in a process. I think that one of the things that really surprised me as I was writing the book was I started watching the talk shows. And when I started watching them, I was prepared to be more, I think, reflexively condemnatory of them because they run somewhat against my grain. And what surprised me when I watched them was I came to realize that the people who were on them oftentimes weren't giving up their privacy. Oftentimes, their privacy, their right for control over access to themselves and to their control to some degree over their private life had long since been destroyed by other people. And one of the reasons that they were talking about it so much publicly was that, in a sense, they were looking for a forum in which to repair it. To give you an example, I watched and read a number of transcripts from shows both that Oprah Winfrey and Phil Donahue and other people ran on the question of incest and pregnancy and babies and families. Now, you would think that this would be the ultimate sacrifice of privacy, to get up in front of 20 million people and to talk about the baby that you had with your father. But as I thought more about it, I realized that that poor woman's privacy had long since been destroyed, because her right to be physically safe and emotionally safe in the privacy and sanctity of her own home had disappeared decades before. And in a sense, she was looking for witnesses to validate for her that it was wrong that it had disappeared that way. Now, whether or not it's a good idea to find witnesses on daytime television, whether that turns out ultimately to be an efficacious process, is a really tough question.
My guest is Jana Malamud-Smith, author of the new book Private Matters. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jana Malamud-Smith, daughter of the late writer Bernard Malamud, and author of a new book about the nature of privacy called Private Matters. Privacy is a word that usually has good connotations. We want privacy, we deserve privacy, we should have privacy. Secrecy is a word that usually has bad connotations. It means you're hiding something, you're ashamed of something. Do you have any idea where privacy ends and secrecy begins, where that withholding of information is a healthy thing and where it becomes an unhealthy thing?
It's a terrific question, and I think that that's a constantly moving shoreline, in the sense that they're always trading off and moving back and forth into each other. Let me give you an example. If I sit down and write in my journal and I close the journal up and leave it on my desk, I've done something private. I've put my private thoughts into my journal, and there they are. If, on the other hand, someone comes along and sits down at my desk without my invitation and starts reading through that journal, the next time I write in it, chances are I'm going to hide it somewhere and lock it up in a drawer, so that what starts for me as private becomes secret because someone else is seeking it out. Or, for example, if a gay man has to hide his sexuality from his coworkers or hide his sexual orientation, he might just want it to be private. He might not want to hide it at all. He might just not want to talk about it that day. But if his job is on the line, then he's forced with that to make it secret. So it's always something that's based on what the context is around you at any given moment, and how, for example, how much, because privacy is important for allowing us to be vulnerable. And because that vulnerability allows some of the best parts of our humanness, our willingness to be loving, to be intimate, and so on, when that vulnerability is threatened from the outside, then we begin to hide and become secret. The problem with secrecy is that we're so busy shielding ourselves from all eyes at that point that we often then have to deal with the fact that many of our own impulses are not totally wonderful, and all of us have a great capacity to start corrupting secrecy towards our own ends.
Now, over the years, when you and your mother have been deciding how public to make your father, Bernard Malamud's, letters and unpublished manuscripts and so on, have you wondered where the impulse was for privacy and where the impulse was for secrecy? Things that you'd be embarrassed if they got out, or you're afraid you'd be, that he would have been embarrassed if he were alive and people knew this about him.
It's a really good question. I don't think it's so much that he would have been embarrassed if people knew this stuff about him. I wish I were that altruistic as to be really protecting that. I think I'm more wanting not to be more known than the next person in the block, in that sense. I mean, I think that it's, for me, it isn't about keeping any particular thing secret. It's about wanting to have as good privacy as all the people that I meet during my day. you know, imagine it or have, you know, for yourself that, you know, suddenly there was a biography out about someone who was near and dear to you or you that you hadn't authorized. All of a sudden, people just know a ton about you that you haven't told them. And there's something about the way that we ask people to treat what we tell them in an intimacy that changes the way they hold information about us. And it's more that that I think is really on my mind about it.
Elaborate on that for me.
Well, that if you and a close friend, or if I sit down with a close friend and I say, you know, I'm really sad because such and such happened, and let me tell you about it, and I go into detail and I tell this story, I trust that that friend will hold that story, that she'll, whatever she might think about some of what I tell her at that moment, I know that she loves me, that she cares about me, that she will value the story, that she'll try and say something honest to me about what my part might have been, that it maybe it shouldn't have been, or whatever those exchanges are. But it will be an ongoing part of our relationship that these stories go back and forth, so that she'll hold that information about me in the context of our relationship. If the same amount of intimate information goes out about me to people who don't know me, it's a very different experience because they don't hold it in the same way. They don't hold it so carefully or with some love to help temper the ucky parts or with some thoughtfulness that might come out of a relationship.
I think you're saying, too, it's just another way to pass judgment on you. Oh, I don't like her because she did this.
I think that's right. And I think that the reason that's important isn't just so much about my feelings, but it's because we do so much of that in the celebrity culture,
mm-hmm.
That we end up, one of the things that sort of struck me as I was writing the book is that we end up creating a more narrow idea of how we ought to be as people. That just as we start condemning people for behaviors that we see in them that we take out of context because we can't really know the context. I mean, take, for instance, the woman in the Air Force, Flynn, I think is her name. Yeah, we don't really know what happened in that relationship. It only comes to us as an adultery, and she gets condemned for an adultery. And because it's such a narrow way of understanding all the richness and all the vicissitudes and all the struggles in a person's life that might have led her to this relationship that sounds sort of crummy, it ends up reducing our view of how people should live their lives and what kinds of mistakes they should be allowed to make and what it takes to grow up and how much tripping around you sometimes have to do in order to find yourself or to find a good relationship or to become mature or all of these things. So that I think that somehow the way that we voice things in the public culture ends up coming back on all of us in ways that probably are constricting and not terribly useful to other ideas we might have about people's development.
I'm wondering if writing this book on privacy changed any of your thoughts about privacy in your own life or protecting the privacy of your late father, Bernard Malamud.
Well, I think sort of ironically, maybe it made me lighten up a little bit in the sense that I spent so much time thinking about it and really reading about it and trying to sort of soak in and develop my own ideas about it, that I feel both that privacy is extraordinarily precious part of life, and I understand better why I cherish it as much as I do and why we should all have the right to cherish it. And at the same time, I came to understand that some part of what I was protecting and protecting my father's privacy was somewhat protecting him from my own aggression and my own wish to write and sort of share the public voice with him a little bit.
In a culture in which there's so much open discussion on the media and so much potential invasion of privacy on the internet, we really have to decide what is it that we most want to keep private and what is it that doesn't really matter, you know, if other people know about it. What are your guidelines for that now, both in terms of your life and your thoughts about, like, the larger culture?
I'm not so sure I know an answer about my own life. I mean, I certainly want to most protect my family life with my husband and my sons and my work with my patients, but I feel that those things are pretty totally where I want them to be in terms of just being private, because they are. But I think in the larger culture, I think we have to be really careful that we don't erode values that we set on other things by invading privacy. And that's a muddy way to say it. But let me give you an example. One of the examples I use in the book is that I noticed in a local magazine that they were selling video cameras that hid in teddy bears so that you could videotape your nanny taking care of your kids so that when you left the nanny alone with the kids for 16 hours while you went off to your job, you didn't have to worry that the nanny was maybe behaving differently behind your back than she was when you were there. And this sort of struck me as a terrible way of dealing with dilemmas in human trust, because not only were you disrespecting your nanny by spying on her, but you were further disrespecting her and your kids by believing that anybody should be able to spend 16 hours with kids alone, without community support, without your support, without being allowed to be with other people in different ways. And so that you were supporting with technology and technological spying and vigilance some ideas about how human beings should be that are really, to my mind, not terribly healthy ideas.
And so that's an example of a technology you don't think we should be using.
I think we should be, with all these technologies, I think we should just, it isn't that we can get rid of any of them probably, or that we should per se throw them all out the window at all. I'm not suggesting that. I'm more suggesting that what we haven't done so much is think about what the downside might be of moving towards some of these technologies. And I think we're moving towards them in a kind of reflexive panic about how much we don't know. But I think we don't then think enough about what we might be giving up in the process of moving toward them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Jenna Melamed-Smith is the author of Private Matters.